we want to talk about lots of things that Matt has on his mind. I just want to say a word about something very much on my mind, besides so much else. Today is a big day. I'm in Chicago, so I'll put it this way. Today is a big day south of the border. I know I have listeners that tune in from all over the world. Venezuela is my ground zero today. That is ground zero for a non-war zone. Well, there's an electoral war going on. I wrote a number of articles about the election that finally is taking place today. And my article today I called Expect Bolivarian Victory in Venezuela. Oh, I think Chavez will win. It's just a matter of how much. When he was reelected last time in 2006, I recollected an article I wrote about it. And the article was that his victory was greater than any president in U.S. history. If you can imagine, his margin of victory, he won just shy of 63%. I won't be too long, Matt. I want to get you into this. Just under 63%, something like 62.8% of the vote. I really talk about a landslide. I don't know why the competition even bothered to show up. Well, not quite in U.S. history. Since 1824, I checked it, since 1824, the only reason was that in 1820, the previous U.S. election, James Monroe won nearly unopposed. He got 80% of the vote. If you don't have an opponent, or one that really amounts to anything, maybe your next-door neighbor, then you can win overwhelmingly, and that's what James Monroe did in 1824. America's first president, George Washington, he wasn't elected, he was anointed. But that's another story. Anyway, we come around again 6 years later. My goodness, seems like yesterday it was 2006. Now it's 2012, and it's a very big day for Venezuelans because what's at stake is populism versus neoliberalism, you know, exploitation, taking away all the social benefits that Chavez gave the Venezuelan people. I just can't imagine that a majority will not want to keep them. Do they want to give up free education and health care, subsidize housing for poor people who need it, subsidize food for people who, if they didn't have the subsidies, just might not eat as well as they do, and all kinds of other things? It's all mandated in the Constitution. In the Constitution, there's not a word in America's Constitution about any of this stuff. Anyway, it's a big day. Polls close later in, I don't know what time. I think they'll keep them open as long as there are lines. I think that's what they do in Venezuela. There's a closing time, but if people are still queued up to vote, they're not going to say, sorry, it's too late. They're going to let it go until the lines get through and everybody who wants to vote has a chance to vote. That's what democracy looks like. There's a lot of things that democracy looks like in Venezuela that does not exist in America. Anyway, Matt, welcome. I didn't mean to go on so long.
Not at all, Stephen. It's my pleasure to listen.
There's
How are you?
So much happening. I want to let you jump into the things that you're focusing on.
Oh, well, I think that I can't imagine anything more important today than what you identify with the Venezuelan election and what that is indicative of. I think you, as usual, zero in really well on what's at stake. A populist initiative that is historic, has been ongoing now among the ALBA countries and South America for several years. It has been shaken with the ouster of Lugo in Paraguay, of course. But the circumstance in Venezuela is one to be watched very closely for that matter. You pit populism against neoliberalism. I have to, when I bring up those terms, I have to explain to my students what liberalism originates from, not what it has been anointed by the press, and that neoliberalism, for that matter, is a return to a colonial outlook hatched in the 19th century, and that populism is the alternative means that some kind of appeal to the people some kind of appeal to the very basic rudiments of democracy, which is that everyone has the basics, the necessities of life. As Franklin Roosevelt said, a necessitous man cannot be a free man. That prior to freedom, there is something like need that cannot be gainsaid, it cannot be reduced. And measuring that need is what populism tries to give account. Neoliberalism, on the other hand, is antithetical. It is a doctrine that's hatched again in the late 20th century to justify American exceptionalism, so-called, bringing its brand of democracy, so-called, to the rest of the world. So there are a lot of semantic twists and turns in discussions like this. Language can be incredibly confusing and beguiling. But I like what you're doing with it, Stephen. You're zeroing in so well on the issues at hand. I was, in preparing for our chat today, I was reviewing some materials online and otherwise, Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, which I read a few years ago and came back to glance again. The idea of populism is disparaged now in the U.S. as demagoguery, as cheap appeals by thuggish, incompetent leaders to people who are desperate for any kind of appeal. That the promise of populist leaders, as with Chavez, never come to fruition because they are detached from the disciplines of market economics, and that, for that matter, they are prone to collapse and imploding. There was a fine film made a few years ago about the election of, I'm spacing out his name, candidate who had twice elected to president in Bolivia, and the one who just preceded Evo Morales. I'm sorry, I'm spacing his name. Longo was his pet name. And, you know, the film gave an insider's account of the firm hired by Longo to manage his campaign. And that firm was James Carville and Company, famous for Clinton's first campaign for presidency, successful campaign. And it was a very, very candid look inside and access to the principles of that company and others as the campaign went along. And one of those principles gave this denunciation of populism and his prophecy that this never can work. And we saw with that circumstance that Longo was run out of government because of a failure to meet the needs, the essential needs of the people. And this led to Morales' victory not long thereafter. So this neoliberalist tribe, of which Carvel and so many others are so devoted and serve as frontmen to propagate the standard lines of laundered dicta about how free markets are the best markets, so-called free markets, they assure that there will be a reaction that they can always denounce because they refuse to give full account of the people and their needs. That's a long-winded way of coming about round to your concern about Colombia.
Well, it concerns me as well, Matt. Such important stuff. And, you know, when people talk about free markets, I'm a product of the Wharton School, so I got my share of indoctrination back then, although I don't remember anybody teaching me the fine points of plunder and exploiting other people. I don't remember that ever coming up in any of my classes. And
part of free market.
Well, the one comment I wanted to make about free market, when people, neoliberals or whatever, talk about free markets or free trade, they never talk about fair markets or fair trade. The word fair never gets into it. It's always free. Well, and what they leave out is most important. Free for whom? And who gets left out of that freedom? I mean, that's what it really comes down to. I have nothing against free whatever that's free for everybody equally. Nobody gets an advantage over anybody else. Everybody gets the same shot. And, I mean, that's my definition of free, which also is fair. And but that's not the way the system runs. It certainly is not the way it is in America and in Western societies.
Yes. It is not. The notion of free, of course, is a buzzword that is associated with any number of other shibboleths about American supremacy, moral supremacy in the world. So freedom has to be unpacked, as you identify. Absolutely. The notion of fairness is, of course, fundamental to any kind of competitive proposition. Freedom is a way of avoiding what corporate America is dead set against, which is competitive markets. That's the last thing that corporate America wants, is a competitive market. That's a grave threat to corporate control. And for that matter, we see in our country the spiraling towards what some call a political economy of fear and terror. That's part of what, when we spoke earlier, I wanted to touch on, but I'd have to say, preface this by saying I've done no research on this. It's something I wish to examine more closely, which is the rise of risk management doctrine in United States and where that comes from and what are its what is the premises behind that, and how its effect on human resource management is profound, from institutions of higher ed to corporate America to nonprofit and otherwise. But again, I've done very little on it. Maybe we can get back to that a little bit later in the chat.
Oh, that reminds me of, if I can remember the exact title, the book that the Australian Alec Carey wrote about democracy. Alex Carey is no longer with us. He wrote a book. Oh, yeah, the book was titled Taking the Risk Out of Democracy. And he was talking about the propaganda system that, you take the risk out of democracy by not letting any of the dark stuff see the light of air. So you hide it, and that's what the propaganda system is all about. And of course, the media is the mouthpiece of state propaganda. In totalitarian countries, well, the state controls everything. All the media is state controlled. Well, you know, it may be privately owned in America, but really there's a nexus between the private, the privately controlled major media, the media I call scoundrel media, Matt, for good reason, and they work very cooperatively with government. I just wrote about one thing in an article just recently. I wrote about it once before when the Bush administration was illegally spying on everybody, but they were breaking the law, breaking U.S. law, breaking international law. They didn't want anybody to know what they were doing. That was in Bush's first term. I think it was around 2003 or 2002 he began it. And the New York Times found out about it. I guess they have all kinds of contacts, and they found out about it. And they went along with the Bush administration to say nothing. To say absolutely nothing, and for two or three years they maintained silence, and then a few years after, when they should have published a report on this, they said something, and they probably got a green light. Okay, you know, we've been at this a long time. Maybe little things leak out here, leak out there. Okay, go ahead and write your article. And it came out with that time lag. Well, it should have come out right away. Real journalism, when they find out important things people need to know, like the government is illegally spying on you, that should be a front page headline story, not for one day, another day, follow-up stories. They should hold the feet of government to the fire and make them cut that stuff out. And if we had a legitimate courts in the country, they should prosecute people breaking the law. I mean, what the heck is the law there for, Matt, if it isn't there for everybody to obey it? If you or I break the law and we get caught, we'll pay big time. But, you know, if the bankers get caught, if the other corporate crooks get caught, if the politicians in Washington, most of them get caught, doesn't make any difference. Just go right back and do it all over again.
It's, you know, when chatting about this, one wonders how long it's been this way. You know, how long there has been the pretense to democratic first principles in our country, and how long the system has been prone to being gamed because press has been culpable, Stephen. Of course, we know historically that in terms of the amount of daily press that was available and independently owned over the course of the country's history has declined precipitously, steadily and precipitously. And if democracy is a function to a certain extent of many voices freely enfranchised and not beholden to centralized interests, then it follows naturally that the greater the media becomes concentrated in its ownership, the less democratic it is. It's indicative also, it seems to me, Stephen, of a spiraling Tower of Babel that we have in this country when a publication like New York Times, scandalized, used so often by the bully pulpit of the populist right wing, as with Tea Party, Sarah Palin et al., as being a liberal, you know, as indicative of the liberal media. You see, they have it coming both ways. The New York Times, on the one hand, says very little in a timely fashion, like what you describe, but is the punching bag of the populist right wing as the liberal elite, the Eastern liberal establishment. Of course, that goes way, way back in right wing populist concern. One can take that all the way back to Andrew Jackson. And one can find a lot of legitimacy in the critiques of an Eastern financial elite. Absolutely. What's beguiling is that populist right wing can be so obtuse and so convoluted in its assessment of what is really undermining the liberties and values they esteem or claim to esteem. Where can we go for a honest magistrate of the day's news? Can we go to The Nation magazine? I'm not sure. You know, The Nation magazine in the 9/11 truth movement was getting some traction back in 2005, came out very long in the tooth and claw to disparage and scandalize that movement as hysterical and prone to the paranoid style, as it were, in American paranoid style in American politics. And while refusing to take up the material evidence that the truth movement scientists and others were posing, and this dodge would persist, of course, with agent provocateurs like Jonathan Kay, Canadian newspaper publisher, who would publish this, this remarkable screed. What was it? My Year with the Truthers or something like that, went around interviewing people in the truth movement and then misrepresenting what they had to say. Very much a shill for an agenda that is terribly threatened by the forensic evidence on the ground for the 9/11 incident.
Well, Matt, I must say that at one time I subscribed to The Nation magazine, and I canceled my subscription over a decade ago because when the Afghan war broke out after 9/11, just 4 weeks after 9/11, 5 weeks maybe, October 6th, 9/11, October 6th, yeah, just about 4 weeks, The Nation magazine endorsed that war, supported the war. The war was illegal aggression, and Nation magazine supported it. And I think in the run-up to the Iraq war, it supported the idea of getting rid of Saddam. Well, again, international law is very clear. I mean, they have writers. They can do the same kind of research I do all the time. I'm not a lawyer, but I can read, and I can look up international law. It's not hard to understand. The basics really are very simple, and I've quoted international law an awful lot. I do it so often that people think I'm a lawyer, but I'm not. And international law is very clear, saying no nation may interfere in the internal affairs of another unless they have been attacked and they can do it in self-defense. or if the attack is so obviously imminent that they have a right to protect themselves, you know, the troops are marshaled on the border and they're just about to cross it, they have a right to defend themselves. And even then, they can only do it until the Security Council acts. The Security Council has final say. You can continue the hostilities or you have to cease them. That's all there in plain English that anybody can see. Nation Magazine, all the others can quote from it and know what the law is. And to support an illegal war is unconscionable. And right now, Nation Magazine, through thick or thin, they support Obama. They support Obama. They really think there's a difference between Obama and Romney. Well, I say it all the time, and I write it so often. On the things mattering most, the big issues, there's not a dime's worth of difference between them. They'll get a little critical at times about some of his policies. They wish he did this better and that better and whatever. But they absolutely support Obama. They want him reelected, and they think literally Armageddon will have arrived if Romney is elected. Again, their people aren't stupid. So why don't they tell their readers the truth? Well, they don't. And programs like Democracy Now!, I'm afraid, that at times does wonderful work and at other times just shames itself. 9/11 is one issue, Matt, where it just shamed itself. I remember the one time in since I was in the Army back stationed at Fort Ord near the Bay Area, down in Monterey, just 100 miles south of the Bay Area, and I went up there on occasion, but I was there 4 years ago, and I happened to be there on the 9/11 anniversary, 2008, and one of the local Berkeley stations or Oakland stations had the Democracy on now on in the morning, and instead of discussing what should have been discussed about 9/11, the whole program was, I didn't listen to or watch the whole program. But I couldn't stand it. I had to turn it off. But the program, based on the way it was introduced, was really honoring the memory of those who died on that tragic day. Well, indeed, it was a terrible tragedy. It was also a crime. It was a crime. It was what turned out to be massive war crimes that followed. It was a crime against humanity. It was a state-sponsored event. I mean, none of that entered into the discussion of the day. A whole hour on the 9/11 issue, and it was all about honoring the victim, the families of the victims, and so on. It was a disgraceful program. I simply couldn't stand it, and I just tuned out.
Stephen, I'm so glad you bring this up, and for all the work you do on your program. It's, for guys like me sitting on the side here and, you know, doing academic work and have, you know, the challenge of working with students on this stuff, it's just incredibly encouraging to hear some conviction of courage on the air. I'll tell you, in my disappointment with Amy Goodman, too, very much assisted with your hard work on Syria and the attack in Homs, you know, she continues to ply the party line. She very, very briefly had an alternative perspective in the discourse she's been hosting about Syria, very, very briefly, and then quickly reverted back to the shill that she's been counting on for commentary. And when that got worn out, she just repeats the party line. And regular news now on her opening segment about what's going on is you could get it from the Wall Street Journal. And I'd like, in some of the time we have here, too, to discuss this complicity of the so-called, I don't know what to call the Nation and Democracy Now. What they do is they displace a real left and a real critique is what they do. Their complicity in this is always, as you say, you know, selective, and I think it's important to zero in on what ways they are selective. I'm no media expert, analyst, or scholar, much less, but I do recognize patterns when they're in front of me long enough, and it seems to me that from the Nation to the New Yorker magazine, in a different way, New Yorker is much more conservative in its way than the Nation, but they are Mutt and Jeff when it comes down to issues of peering behind the curtain of U.S. Federal government treachery and beguiling mischievous actions. They refuse, both of them, to take up what's going on in the government itself.
Well, Matt, the so-called liberal media represented by Democracy Now! And Nation Magazine and National Public Radio and Public Broadcasting in America, I mean, these are marvelous tools for the business and for the imperial establishment. I mean, people actually believe in these sources as being legitimate when, in fact, so once in a while they are. But so often and too often on the biggest issues of all, they absolutely are not. And on public radio and broadcasting, people don't realize that they're funded by the government and they're funded by big corporations. And I've written it occasionally, and it's been a while since I said it on this program, but I'll say flatly, nobody in their right mind should give 10 cents to NPR or to PBS. They are agents of corporate and government policies. They certainly don't represent the people. And if you look at the guests they bring on, it's all skewed toward government and business, especially government policies. They certainly don't take an anti-war stance. And, I mean, this is just terrible. The voices of the people are excluded. And when they have segments of ordinary people, they'll just be man-in-the-street kind of stuff. It really amounts to nothing. They would never invite me on. And I had a personal email interchange, Matt, with the ombudsman for PBS. I wrote a very critical article about the NewsHour, the Lyra NewsHour, and to my astonishment, the guy emailed me, and he questioned what I had to say, mentioned his point of view, and we went back and forth a couple of times politely, and I said to him in one of my emails, well, you would never invite me on as one of your guests to present the alternative point of view. I challenge you, I think I put it in those words, I challenge you, invite me on the NewsHour one evening on one of these major topics and let me have my say so your viewers will hear another point of view. I never even got an answer to that email. They wouldn't dare invite me on, Matt.
This gets back to, no, they won't, and this gets back to, as it were, taking the risk out of democracy, right?
Exactly.
The Lehrer NewsHour, formerly McNeil Lehrer NewsHour, was ginned up in the Watergate era as a news venue that would be that would have all the gloss of sort of expert, you know, sober news analysis by people without skin in the game. And you know over the years then it would become really a turnstile for CFR personnel membership who would come in and out. I mean, if I had a nickel for every time Lehrer or McNeil said this or so or other from the Council on Foreign Relations, senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, I'd be doing pretty well by now. It was really a platform for the CFR to propagate a presumptively, you know, sort of sober analytical critique of the day's events, when in fact it was drained entirely of the people's blood of democracy. It was entirely drained of that, and it persists being so. That Lehrer is the sole guy on the now with the so-called Commission for Presidential Debates, which is a private corporation which runs everyone out except the standard shills for plutocracy. Lehrer is the go-to guy, right? Because he's been on the inside for so long. You get back to the point that Democracy Now!, the Nation magazine, and the New Yorker, for that matter, will have some good news once in a while. This is also part of what's beguiling about them.
Oh, indeed. So, Matt, let me interrupt you. The time just goes by so fast. The music means we need to take a short break. Hold your thought, and we'll come back right after the break and pick right up on it.
This is the Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Thank you.
Welcome back. That was indeed a short break. Usually they run a little bit longer than that, a message or two, but whatever. We're back, and the time flies on every program. Matt, it really is extraordinary. I must say, yesterday I completely lost track of time, and we missed the break. We went right past it. I simply had not glanced at the clock and didn't realize. When I did, I was 40 minutes into the program.
Yeah. Well, it's understandable. You know, it's a lot to cover.
There really is a lot to cover, and we try to cover so many of the major issues on this program. I love to let my guests decide what they want to focus on. It could be stuff that you or somebody else is writing about, maybe a new book. But often we come back to the same issues, the basic ones, you know, corporate power, war and peace, these kinds of things. I'll just mention very briefly that the extra article I tucked in yesterday, I wrote about what I think absolutely is what happened, the so-called border incident between Syria and Turkey, a Syrian mortar landing in Turkish territory and killing five Turkish nationals. That was by chance that it killed people. It could have landed in an open field. I don't think mortars have that kind of precision. I don't think artillery does either, better than it did years ago. But it happened, and just a little before airtime, I discovered that for the fifth consecutive day, there are interchanges going on between Turkey and Syria. But the bottom line is that Syria has had nothing whatsoever to do with launching mortars, whether they landed in Syria, in Turkey, or any place else. Nothing whatsoever to do with these border incidents. And the so-called Free Syrian Army, which are recruited death squads by the West and their regional allies, they have admitted responsibility for this. They have spots of territory in Syria they control. They were given mortars by the Turkish military, the same kind of mortars that NATO uses. They're being trained by Turkey and other Western or regional countries. Maybe Qatar, maybe Saudi Arabia, maybe other Western countries, dare I say Washington, Britain, France, they're up to their ears in this fight. So they're training them, they're giving them the weapons. They're the ones that lobbed these mortars that landed in Turkish territory, and I called it what it is, a false flag. I mean, this is risky stuff. This literally could start a war.
Yes. It's very alarming. What this incident in Turkey is very, very alarming, and that it's false flag is, you know, what it is, Stephen. I think that one thing that my work with others in our regarding the state crimes against democracy framework that Lance Haven Smith originated back in an article in 2006, otherwise was in a pretty obscure academic journal, but that's gotten substantial traction in the years since. What we're trying to do is identify how, among other things, empire begins at home. Empire begins in the first place with the subjugation of the domestic population, one way or the other. And Lance, in his scholarship, has traced the escalation of this of these tactics post-World War II, when there was increasing secrecy in U.S. government, the subsystems, the iron triangles of government with you know, these turnstile, they're not cabals, they're under the auspices of procedure, but where these lobbyists and legislative aides and industry insiders have had venue, nominally official at the federal level for decades now, to hash out legislative initiatives, work out the kinks. These are all done very much in private, and they're so highly decentralized, there's no way to keep track entirely of what they're up to by the press, at least by anything other than a very diligent press. And we do not have a very diligent press. That combined with increasing authorization of secrecy attributed to this or that process, has made what's going on at the federal level since World War II
something substantially different than what it was prior to that time. This nation has never been exactly a paragon of democratic virtue, but we do see a shift post-World War II with the escalation of a bipolar hostilities to the Cold War and the cover that provided for the mischief that would culminate with this or that October surprise, this or that false flag. And, you know, there's a narrative, as it were, here that is really important to bring to the surface when we critique a venue like The Nation or Democracy Now. And I'd like to go over that briefly with you and get a sense of what you're thinking about this.
Oh, go ahead, man.
You're familiar with the standard response to the to the theory of the truth movement and radical democratic doctrine in general about false flag events and so on. You're familiar with the standard response. There's actually, as Lance reminded me in chatting with him the other day, there's a three-point response, but the typical one that people are familiar with is the two-point retort to the claim that something as horrific as 9/11 could be an inside job. And that two-point retort is, you know, that anything so complicated as pulling off what occurred, it's a completely incoherent and illogical retort, but I think it's very important to bring to the surface. Anything so complicated would be beyond the capacity of the federal government to carry off because it's cleaved by so many turf wars. Constitutional provisions for balance of power would mean that there's always antagonism between the branches of government and that one establishing a cabal over the other two would be implausible. So there is the complication complexity retort. And then there is the loose lips retort that follows it, that even if supposing the U.S. government capable of any number of military initiatives across the globe that are against various dubious odds and been remarkably successful for the most part, requiring a tremendous amount of secrecy and logistical chains of support. Never mind all of that complexity, but whatever. If somehow the federal government, otherwise presumably cleaved by these factions and balance of power doctrine, even if it was able or had been had succumbed to a powerful unitary cabal, then eventually, because so many people would have to be involved in something like carrying off a 9/11 event, someone would talk eventually. Someone would say something, it would get out to the press. So this is the usual two-part retort. There's actually a premise preceding this two-part retort, which is that cabals and subversions and conspiracies are not necessary in democracies because we have routinized a transition of power by virtue of presidential elections and, in general, popular sovereignty. And I think it's very important for us to unpack the presumptuousness behind these assumptions, this gainsaying of, which is basically an avoiding of the issue. It's shifting the burden of proof. It's a rhetorical ploy to distract from the fundamental challenges posed by an initiative like the Truth Movement for the Movement for 9/11 Truth. But this is sort of the backbeat that emanates from any discussion on the street or in kitchens or in offices. You know, well, wait a minute. You know, the informed ignorant, what I call the white noise of informed ignorance, is quick to respond with, well, it's too complicated, and anyway, someone would talk. And if it's too complicated, how did 19 hijackers with box cutters pull it off? Is sort of the obvious, you know, sort of the obvious response. But there's certainly more engaged and fuller response to this being so complicated. And again, in this sort of rhetorical ploy of shifting burden of proof, we have to ask questions like, why was NORAD totally non-responsive on 9/11? Why the confusion in emergency transmissions about what was going on and trying to establish was just part of the military games being carried out on that day, or was it a real attack? Why, score, scores of incident that don't add up have never been questioned. That democracy, that the U.S. democracy is immune to inside jobs, conspiracy, and being taken over by a cabal. That conspiracy is somehow anathema to the leadership culture of the United States. Misplaces a history that begins in the first place with a conspiracy against the British Crown. A conspiracy against the British Crown that was based on a presumption that the British Crown was itself conspiring against the colonies. Conspiracy is woven into the, inextricably woven into the fabric of this country's political culture. It was the basis for the writing of the Constitution as it was, for the adopting of balance of power doctrine, for the separation of powers for the various branches and their veto authority. And overrides of veto. The suspicion of cabal and faction, as it used to be called, is irreducibly part of what this country became in the first place. Suspicious of power that is conspiratorial itself, because the founders, so-called, knew in the crisis of revolution what is entailed to win in conspiring against an absolute authority. So they were very, very, very wary of this, and our history is punctuated by this wariness of inside jobs, high crimes. Andrew Jackson's of the First National Bank, the Lincoln's challenge of Polk about the Mexican-American War, the conspiracy theory attributed to Lincoln for Fort Sumter, the sinking of the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor, Gulf of Tonkin, all of this is indicative of a country that is very wary of high crime being carried out. But something happened with the assassination of John F. Kennedy and a decade of violent assassination of Democratic leaders. Something happened that was very, very important. It was the disparaging for the first time of what had otherwise been indelibly part of political culture in America, and under the rubric conspiracy theorists, and that conspiracy theorists were somehow paranoid and delusional. And there was a very concerted campaign to attach to any skepticism of the federal government in the Cold War era that it was otherwise very well founded, that somehow this was a paranoid presumption. And then we would hear, the next thing we're going to hear is that there were shots coming from the grassy knoll. And we're both old enough to recall that type of disparaging comment. It was very successful in curbing and bridling the ambitions of press that would otherwise, perhaps like Democracy Now, say the whole truth and nothing but the truth all of the time. Now we have, very interestingly, something like Democracy Now! And The Nation that say the whole truth and nothing but the truth some of the time. And that's incredibly effective distraction, because the public, for the most part, doesn't wish to explore the trauma entailed with wondering if their leaders could be so evil. And that is something we have to understand much better. A colleague of ours, Laurie Manuel, at Guelph University, University of Guelph in Canada, has done remarkable work here in the social psychology of terror, and how the trauma that attaches to terror events subdues rational thought, and from there is associated with any questioning of the official story a return to that same trauma. And so psychologically, these trauma events like 9/11 and otherwise have a remarkable effect on the channels of democracy that we just don't understand or talk about nearly enough. Well,
very,
I could go on.
Very, very definitely, Matt. And I like to talk about the big lie. If you repeat it often enough, people are going to believe it, and that's exactly what happens. And whether whatever it is, I mean, it's one thing after another, whether it's a major incident like 9/11, whether it's a particular false flag operation, if it's claiming somebody is a terrorist and you arrest them and the person makes headlines and it just happens the person did absolutely nothing. But if you keep saying that the person did often enough, the public doesn't take the time to wonder, is this true or is it false? And so often, most of the time, especially issues related to national security, issues related to anything that may benefit or may harm corporations, you're going to be fed a pack of lies, and they're going to be repeated over and over again. I mean, we were fed the pack of lies about the U.S. debt has really reached a crisis level, and we have to cut the budget, not the military budget, not the banker's budget, not the corporate subsidies budget, not anything to do with Homeland Security. Cut the budget of the things that help people the most, people most in need, you know, and the things that everybody is entitled to if they paid for them, like Medicare and Social Security, Medicaid for people who can't afford to get treated when they're ill. Cut the budget in those respects. Cut food stamps. Cut heating oil for impoverished people in wintertime. Let them freeze. They're not important. And this is what's going on. There's been one budget cut after another at a time when people need help, not more cuts. And come the beginning of the year, there'll be an automatic cut of $1.2 trillion. I don't think it'll come out all at one time on January 2nd, but it's going to come out pretty quickly. It's going to be some kind of a deal announced. It's possible some of it may be backloaded, but it's already agreed on a program to be instituted. Obama and the Republicans agreed on this right after the first of the year. They didn't want to do it before the election. It wouldn't look good for the incumbent. So after the first of the year, that's a good time to really hit the public hard, because no matter who gets elected, you get 2 years to the next election. Maybe they'll forget about it by then, Matt. But this is the kind of stuff that goes on. And you repeat the big lie that we have to do it because we'll go broke. Obama's actual words, we're broke. The country is broke. Well, how about all those billions and trillions we're spending on imperial wars and all the rest of it? Are we too broke for that? Well, apparently not.
No, we're not. And what these cuts will, of course, assure is desperation. What desperation assures is unrest. What unrest assures is reaction. And that reaction comes within so-called democracy, often from the populist right, that quickly adopts the notion that this is the ravages of, you know, the narrative of the Sarah Palins et al. Is that that desperation is the ravages of socialism. The spin is remarkable, and it's hard to, you know, the genius of it, really, for its effectiveness, is hard to attribute to idiots. So I think these are very grave times, Stephen. I think it's very excellent and important to surface these issues and talk them through, but unless and until we see a movement in this country in particular against this charade of pretentious claims of truth and fact, boy, I don't know what to crystal ball. I think you're in a better position in that regard.
Matt, it looks very grim to me. Certainly in my lifetime, there has never been anything approaching what we're going through right now. This probably is the greatest crisis in U.S. history. It may be the greatest crisis in world history, because literally we have Republicans and Democrats that can't wait to wage another war. They have very powerful weapons that they have no compunction about holding back on. If they want to attack Iran, for its own protection, has a nuclear site deeply buried in a mountain. The only way you can get at it is to use some kind of nuclear device. So if there's a war in Iran to destroy, it's perfect perfectly peaceful, legal nuclear facilities, they're probably going to use some kind of a nuclear weapon. I mean, they use them all the time with depleted uranium, but if they start using the kind of stuff that was used for, against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I mean, we're talking about immense nuclear radiation affecting millions of people potentially. You're talking about Iran retaliating because Israel would probably be involved in this, so they're going to hit Israel's nuclear sites, which means possibly irradiating Israel and Palestine and maybe the surrounding countries. I mean, this is calamitous. And we have officials in these countries that actually consider doing this stuff. Don't they have any idea what kind of a genie they may unleash from the bottle? I mean, literally, humanity may be on the line. It could be that serious. I don't know that it will be, but the possibility is there, and the possibility should get these people to say, there's no way in the world. Well, I won't have to worry about the history books because they won't be written after this war. But there's no way in the world I would ever want to have anything to do with taking that kind of a risk. But people don't talk that way, and I really fear what's going to be happening ahead, Matt. Exactly when, I don't know. Probably sometime after the election, no matter who it is, Romney or Obama. And, I mean, there's only one word to explain this, and it's called madness. Madness.
It's a madness. It's a criminal insanity, I think. It's criminal insanity, to borrow from John Cobb's analysis of this, theologian John Cobb's analysis of this kind of treachery, this syndrome. Stephen, you know, Nestor Kirchner was speaking with George W. Bush back when he was back during his administration. And I heard this in an interview with Kirchner by Oliver Stone, and his really, really well done, if you can get past Oliver Stone's ego, but otherwise well done documentary, South of the Border, talking to all the presidents. And speaking with Kirchner, Kirchner said, well, speaking with Bush, Kirchner challenged him, saying, you know, the best way to generate wealth is to do so by meeting people's needs. That's where wealth generation always can be sustained and in stable ways. And George W. very candidly, very directly, and according to Kirchner, sort of contemptuously retorted, no, you're wrong. War is the only way, in a stable way, to generate wealth. And he repeated himself several times to Kirchner. You know, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing the criminal insanity of a plutocratic presumption about how wealth is created in this world, and a presumption that is criminally insane, that this is the only way that wealth can be generated and sustained and predicated on a cataclysmic destruction. Getting back to your point that this is the worst crisis, I haven't heard anyone put it quite so bluntly than yourself, and I try to tell my students and otherwise that, you know, in the Great Depression, although we had much higher unemployment, we had the prospects of reindustrializing for commercial development. We have farmed that industrial capacity out of this country in a big way over the last 50 years. And so the depression we face now does not have as a backdrop an industrial capacity that has to be retooled. It simply doesn't exist. And so the desperation we face now is on an order of magnitude much different than what we faced the Great Depression of the 30s. Some have compared to this depression in the 1893 that, or 1880s, that lasted some 20 years. Sort of a longer wave depression. History will tell. But they didn't have nuclear weapons then, and this is your grave point.
Well, that's exactly right. The terrible weapons that exist today, the policies that really talk about the 1%, we have government for the 1% and really the devil with everybody else, and no matter what administration is in office, they simply can't wait to start another war. Well, wars are profitable. You take the profit out of wars, Matt, that would be the simplest way of ending them. But the war profiteers want these wars, and it's not just the defense contractors, the technology companies. dare I say, the toothpaste manufacturer. I mean, everybody makes out in wars. I mean, you got to feed and house and arm the troops and train them, one thing after another. And there's an awful lot of money to be made for wars. And when you destroy stuff, you got to rebuild the parts of it that you want. So that's where the Halliburtons and people like that come in. Their business model depends on war.
Yes. Bush makes a very good point. You substantiate it. And the devil take the hindmost, and God help us all.
God help us all is right, and that's what I fear so much. I never really feared that much during the Cold War, Matt. I felt that the MAD concept, mutually assured destruction, would keep both sides from attacking the other one. It was mostly true. There were a couple of close calls along the way, especially the Cuban Missile Crisis, that both sides didn't quite realize how close we came until they had a reunion some years later. But literally, it was very close, and that's when we had Kennedy as president. Kennedy didn't want a war with anybody. He wanted to get out of Vietnam, and I think that was the main reason he was assassinated. Oh, my goodness, the time has gone by. We are out of time. Matt, we could keep this going another hour easily.
Sure.
I really appreciate you coming on. I look forward to getting you back again. And my listeners know when they tune in, they'll hear issues like this discussed. They'll hear wonderful guests like you discussing them. Above all, Matt, they'll hear the truth. They won't hear the garbage they get when they turn on their TV sets and when they turn on the programs that they once may have thought that were reliable. And I hope they realize that they really are not. But I'm committed to the truth. I'm completely independent. Nobody pays me 10 cents. This is what I want to do, Matt. It's so important. I care about people. I want this planet and this country to survive. I don't want us all to perish. Again, I thank you, Matt.
You bet. My pleasure.
I'll just remind listeners that every weekend we're on at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And on Fridays now, we're on at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Do make it a regular habit.